Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. It will take a long time to repair the damage to American democracy by the protracted and willful seizure of quasi-dictatorial power by a single political party. Yet everyone for and against ought to be aware of the chilling future without constitutional democracy, imperfect as it is to zealotry, deceit, corruption, discriminations of every sort, and of course, always by events of tyranny. It is patently evident that the USA has been traumatically traduced by the appalling presidency of Donald Trump, which was incredulously inserted into the national neural viscera and has precipitated a national coming apart. The USA is at a crossroads as severe and consequential as the Civil War, a crisis of core fundamentals that are democracy's oxygen, liberty, justice, and equality. The USA is a Yankee Doodle come lately, yet we the people stridently brag that we are the primo democracy that everyone else should emulate, the exceptionalist republic. Yet basic civil liberties are dramatically threatened, while average citizens, which includes women and men of all previous origins racially and nationality, are interminably rendered politically impotent, while the country as a whole rapidly retrogresses from a diversely construed democracy primarily centered on the rule of common folk, famously evoked by Abraham Lincoln at Gettysburg 158 years ago. Whatever greatness the USA has possessed seems to be swiftly disintegrating into a black hole, the torch of liberty consumed by unscrupulous despotic sabotage. Americans seem increasingly vulnerable and unfortunately inured to. The underlying themes of autocracy and aristocracy, which were essentially and perhaps only temporarily purged with the Revolution and Constitution, and no less by the Civil War, have never quite evaporated from the national psyche, but have yet not been so bombastically manifested until the abominable and repulsive advent of Donald Trump, the nation's most toxic virus. The Constitution has had many enemies, foreign and domestic, which is virtually a well-worn cliche, but none have been as outrageously threatening to the basis of democracy as Trump's speciously spurious dissemblance of the hollow verities of truth, honesty, and integrity. His every breath is a stench of swaggering dishonesty and sneering mendacity. Perhaps the most egregious example is persistent lie that he won the 2020 election and vicious attempt at virtually overturning the vote by rallying a mob to assault the nation's capital on January 6th, a new date of infamy. The baneful omnipresence of Trump, the wretched years of his presidency, and his desperate insurrection to overrule his defeat has goaded the Republican Party to vilify and denigrate democracy by invalidating the right of the people to freely vote by crippling and suppressing it, especially for non-whites. And with the startling and bitter rise of Trump half a dozen years ago, the complex and fragile fabric of democracy, racial and gender tolerance, and human rights in the United States are eroding rapidly and menaced with brutal collapse resulting from unchecked corruption, malice, and gross inequality. The nation seems reflected in a specter of macabre and distorted mirrors, bizarrely blanched by intolerant and vengeful political schisms that are poised to destroy the bedrock of constitutional protections that were supposed to guard and guarantee democracy. the ancient and atrocious issues of white supremacy and Christian fundamentalism, the suppression and persecution of all other credibilities, are again a major theme in American doctrine, most bizarrely since the advent of profane, paganistic Trump. However much the Republican Party is striving through the resurrection of Trump to attain absolute single-party rule over U.S. politics and government, it has from the very start imperiled its position with blatant arrogance, transparent corruption, and flagrant deceit, as well as willfully treacherous disregard for the Constitution. There probably has not been a more necessary moment since the American Revolution to be aware of our basic rights and obligations as citizens of a democracy and counterpose the resurgence of ultra-nationalist domestic neo-fascism that is determined to stifle and abolish democratic human rights and liberties. We not only possess basic human rights, we have the right to protect our rights and the rights of others. We have a basic responsibility to do so. And I wrote that rant. And now, by David Horowitz, Professor Emeritus of Portland State University, Vietnam Anti-War Protests and the Legacy of Social Movements, with a quote from Bob Dylan, "There's no success like failure, and failure is no success at all." The efficacy of social protest has long mystified observers. For an historian who participated in the Portland State anti-war confrontation of May 1970 during his second year of teaching, the subject is doubly vexatious. It's tempting to invoke James Agee's description of Great Depression tenant farmers as merciful souls, quote, whose righteousness hath not been forgotten, unquote. Yet historians must push further. As easy as it was to tell black from white, it was all that easy to tell wrong from right, a Bob Dylan lyric recalled of an earlier time. A half century later, Barack Obama reminded Howard University students that passion was vital, but you've got to have a strategy, quote unquote. Constructing adequate defenses are a key part of strategy. By May 1970, nearly 50,000 U.S. servicemen and women had been killed in Vietnam. At first, teach-ins, peaceable marches, and massive demonstrations appeared to have little impact. Then racial and political turmoil, including the assassinations of Martin Luther King and peace candidate Robert Kennedy, helped to elect Richard Nixon. The new president promised an orderly withdrawal from Vietnam, yet the incursion into Cambodia and the Kent State killings seemed to widen the conflict at all costs. Demoralized activists might have echoed Albert Camus' verdict on the triumph of Spanish fascism in the 1930s that one can be right, yet be beaten. Force can vanquish spirit, quote unquote. How could the country be convinced to disassociate from the war and reject what Jimmy Carter later called the moral poverty of Vietnam? As Kent State illustrated that even white privilege could not protect young dissenters from repression, millions of American college students joined a national strike. At Portland State, President Gregory Wolfe, whose administration had pursued disciplinary charges against several activists for harassing campus military recruiters, now sought to open channels for dialogue. Yet, as PSU strike historian Dory Hilton has written, dialogue was talk, and student activists had enough of talk. As half the student body and 134 faculty honored the walkout, young protesters from outside the university joined PSU students in erecting barricades to stop traffic on the park blocks. hearing violence between strikers and students who wanted to keep the institution open, Wolf closed the school a few days later. Although PSU strike leaders were committed to nonviolence, they were forced to operate in a hostile national climate in which college campuses, to cite a presidential commission, had become the surrogate for all the tensions and frustrations of American policy in Vietnam. And that's a quote. Even before Kent State, anti-war activists at many institutions had defied public opinion by taking over university offices, shouting down government speakers, or blocking recruiting from military and defense contractors. A second presidential commission even documented 8,200 bombing-related incidents at ROTC facilities and other campus sites between January and May 1970. Although PSU strike leaders diligently policed bad actors, controlling the overall narrative was a challenge. One group sought to stop traffic on nearby Broadway by banging on passing cars and screaming slogans at bewildered drivers. Another initiated a food riot to liberate the student cafeteria, quickly stopped by a radical professor before it erupted into a full-scale brawl with strike opponents. Another problem emerged at the student center, the site of two dances that attracted high school students, street people, and excessive drug and alcohol use. Strike supporters were dismayed at the result, but could do nothing about media reports of missing property and damages to the building. As pressure from non-striking students and letters of outrage from the public multiplied, the PSU strike committee agreed to help police take down the barricades. On the morning of May 11th, however, 50 business students marched to City Hall to demand the campus be cleaned up at once. Mayor Terry Schrunk responded that officials were preparing to resolve the problem. When the mayor learned that some of the barricades were using their bodies as moving barriers, he claimed that strikers had violated their pledge. Meanwhile, Parks Commissioner Frank Ivancy overruled a subordinate who had given verbal permission to keep the strikers' medical tent on the park blocks up for another day. Ivancy's comment that it's time someone shut up these kids came as the mayor ordered the tactical operations platoon, the TAC squad, to tear down any remaining barricades and disassemble the medical tent, the last bastion of the strike. For activists, bearing nonviolent witness to the tent's removal was a matter of honor within the civil disobedience traditions of the early 60s civil rights struggle. Nevertheless, City Hall unleashed a deployment the Faculty Senate later described as a police riot that a subsequent grand jury depicted as incorporating an excessive use of force. PSU strikers felt validated the day after the attack when well over 3,000 people across the university, including many who had not supported the walkout, marched on City Hall to protest the police action. Later in May, President Nixon announced plans to withdraw the troops from Cambodia. At the same time, the White House revealed that Nixon would visit Portland in early September to address the 52nd Convention of the American Legion and lead a Victory in Vietnam parade through downtown. Portland state strike leaders played a central role in organizing what they humorously referred to as a People's Army Jamboree. Yet, as word spread through the underground press, references to another Chicago, quote-unquote, brought up images of the disturbances surrounding the Democratic National Convention in 1968. If razzing Nixon with protesters in the street was the goal, wouldn't authorities mobilize to prevent Oregon from becoming the next arena of civil discord? The situation was not helped by loose talk of revolutionary confrontation filtering out of jamboree organizing sessions. This prompted a group of hip merchants to convince Republican Governor Tom McCall to support an alternative attraction. The result was Vortex One, the first state-supported free rock festival in history, held at MacIver Park, 30 miles away in rural Clackamas County. The countercultural celebration of peace and harmony attracted over 30,000 attendees. Only 200 people attended the Radical Festival at the city's approval site at Delta Park in far-flung North Portland. The Legion and Jamboree each held separate marches, with protesters marshaling 1,200 followers behind a Victory to the Vietnamese banner. When Nixon canceled his appearance and sent Vice President Agnew for a hastily delivered address at the Portland Coliseum, 800 PAJ activists marched around the parking lot. To this day, some Jamboree enthusiasts insist they prevailed by forcing the president to abandon a long-standing pledge to speak wherever he chose. Yet the last word emerged from the Washington Post's Nicholas von Hoffman, who chose to minimize the state's role in discouraging the protest. "The mood here is wrong for massive manifestations," he observed. "The country is too beautiful, the Oregonians too polite and civilized." During the 1970 congressional campaign, Nixon and Agnew continued to conflate radical and moderate activism. War protesters viewed Vietnam as the metaphor of everything wrong with the United States. Yet many Americans saw the extremist rhetoric and adventurism of the militants as the symbols of the nation's decline. Only 10% of respondents had supported protesters against police violence in Chicago in 1968. Yet three-quarters of a Gallup poll recorded unfavorable responses to demonstrators during the mainstream moratorium rallies of 1969. More than half of another sample blamed students, not the National Guard, for the Kent State shootings. By 1970, some polls were reporting that half of the plurality supporting withdrawal opposed anti-war protests. Nixon signed the Paris Peace Accord ending U.S. military activity in Vietnam in 1973. Yet that followed his landslide reelection with nearly 61% of the popular vote in a campaign that demonized the movement. How can we reconcile public endorsement of withdrawal with disapproval of war opponents? What movement attributes made it possible for Nixon to continue rallying base support for the war until his reelection let him walk away from it? In America Divided, the Civil War of the 1960s, former Portland State student Michael Kazin and Maurice Isserman have spoken to these points by picturing the radicals in the anti-war coalition as participants in a moral crusade, whose sole aim was to immediately end the conflict. As such, they rejected incremental standards of success, such as a negotiated settlement, a timetable for withdrawal, or a cessation of bombing. The result was a tendency to alternate millennial and utopian expectations with utter despair, opening the door to tolerance of extremist violence and impatience with the democratic process. As early as 1973, progressive journalist Eleanor Langer noted how elements of the movement were immersed in their own fantasy of American evil with little room for compromise. Believing they were in a unique position to see through the hypocrisy and inhumanity of an impregnable capitalist system, wrote Langer, theorists insisted that free agency was a myth and that ordinary people suffered from a media-infused false consciousness. Activists tied these views to the belief that Vietnam was part of a global imperial venture to prop up the capitalist order against third world insurgency. "Losing faith in the ability of the American people to carry out their own revolution," she argued, "the left mythologized authoritarian foreign agents of change, whatever their repressive or violent bent. others on the fringes looked to direct action amid cries that the war was coming home. Activities ranged from occupying armed forces induction centers, burning draft cards, desecrating the American flag, and displaying Viet Cong banners to engaging in street action with police. After 1969, the weather underground of former activists from Students for a Democratic Society planted explosive devices at selected government facilities while issuing revolutionary communiques advocating guerrilla warfare. Committed to social chaos to either exhaust public tolerance for the war or enact revenge, radical cadres left most Americans caught in a pointless conflict between an untrustworthy government and a disloyal minority whose affluence enabled many to avoid military service. In conjunction with recurring inner-city race riots and the confrontational tactics of Black Panthers, it was easy to believe the country was under siege. Apart from the radical movement's association with nihilistic violence, its moral shaming seemed to characterize the entire population as dishonorable or as privileged racists. The cause was further damaged by counterculture critiques of the work ethic, family cohesion, and personal decorum. Activists also failed to appreciate that whatever the reasons for involving the country in the questionable war, the allegiances of its mainly poor and working class warriors were often tied to the virtues of service, sacrifice, pride, and family loyalty. Much as protesters chanted, "We're not against the soldiers, we're against the war," amid pleas to bring the troops home, radicals appeared to be the first in the world, warned African-American critic Julius Lester, to seek a revolution in a country they hated. Assessing the legacy of Vietnam protest requires a degree of emotional intelligence and the ability to hold opposing ideas at the same time. The lessons of tragedy, the ability to learn from mistakes as well as seeming triumphs, seems particularly relevant. In our own time, authoritarian assaults on democratic values and practices have increased the stakes and changed the rules of engagement. When former protections such as the rule of law, democratic elections, and even the physical security of office holders are threatened from the kind of people Theodore Roosevelt referred to as robust creatures who do not mean well, quote unquote, the need for forging alliances is obvious. It is tempting for academics to rally behind contemporary social justice issues. Yet we may best serve these causes not as mere cheerleaders, but as allies who can point to the role of self-discipline, common sense, humility, empathy, and trust in others when possible. Michael Kaysen's American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation, notes the importance of utopian visions that reach beyond what was to what ought to be and to the difficulty of attaining the possible without reaching for the impossible. Yet Kaysen acknowledges that while prospects of a better world may be essential in motivating people to social action, idealists usually wind up serving more limited reforms. Although compromise is not always feasible, historians know that people in the streets are never the sole agents of change. Articulating the existence of a grievance is not the same as summoning the strategic agility to resolve it. Demonstrations can push the political class into reevaluating its options, but as in the early civil rights movement, political transformations ultimately depend upon the levers of legislative or judicial power, not a simple triumph of the will. Boutique appeals to like-minded compatriots risk contributing to what political scientist Eaton D. Hirsch dismisses as mere hobbyism. Whether war or social justice is at stake, Success has to depend on acknowledging broader public interests and sensibilities. Socialist leader Norman Thomas seemed to understand this when he regretted that radical Vietnam War opponents did not wash the American flag instead of burning it. A basic concept of conflict resolution is that it's not what we say, but what the other person understands. Finding common ground, however, does not mean sacrificing core principles. It's all in the framing. One can find appropriate models in Franklin D. Roosevelt's maxim that we all go up or we all go down, or Barack Obama's acknowledgement that Black lives matter, no more, no less. By no means should an examination of the Vietnam protest legacy degenerate into criticism of the Portland State activists of 1970. Facing few alternatives, strike leaders acted honorably and patriotically to oppose a brutal and debilitating conflict that never served the nation. A good deal of the negative responses they encountered were shaped by developments on both the local and national scene beyond their control. One shudders to think what the absence of protest would mean for American democracy. Nevertheless, the strike reminds us how difficult it can be for even the most diligent activists to control the narrative and minimize inevitable blowback. That's why social movements must do their best to avoid granting opponents and opportunists ammunition they do not deserve. This is particularly true when present-day threats offer the most existential dangers to democracy since the specter of fascism rose before a broken world in the 1930s. Once again, a Bob Dylan lyric seems to speak to our times. Let us not talk falsely now, the poet wrote. The hour is getting late. That was by David Horowitz, Vietnam Anti-War Protest and the Legacy of Social Movements. And David is Professor Emeritus of History at Portland State University, still after more than half a century. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser Schalk is engineer of this program. It seems that another right-wing radio ranter who incited vaccination resistance has died of COVID-19. His name was Bob Enyart, and his Denver, Colorado broadcast was called Real Science Radio, from which he claimed that COVID vaccines were tested, quote, on the cells of aborted babies, unquote. He also called for women who have abortions should face the death penalty and mocked people who died of AIDS. More than 600,000 Americans have died from the COVID virus, virtually equal to the deaths in the USA from the influenza plague a century ago.